We're talking about climate energy rankings and Milwaukee's goals in the transition to renewables. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, it published its Clean City Energy Scorecard recently, ranking 100 U.S. cities on their clean energy efforts across five policy areas. Madison and Milwaukee in the mix of those 100. Madison showed one of the largest year-over-year jumps. Milwaukee ranks slightly lower. What do you want to say about your community's plans to transition to clean energy? Where do you see barriers for your household to power off of renewables? 800-642-1234. Eric Schamberger is Environmental Sustainability Director for the City of Milwaukee, leading the Environmental Collaboration Office, which was created under the Barrett administration. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me, Kate. It's exciting to be here.
Well, good morning. Milwaukee scoring 25 points out of 100, ranking 53rd of the 100 cities evaluated. Was that a fair rating?
Well, I think it's reasonably fair. I have about four categories about how we got to this ranking that I'd like to touch on today, if we could. You know, first of all, is what we've done, what the organization missed, where we need help from our state and our utility, and then what we are planning going forward with our climate and equity plan.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, this organization is the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. They are ranking cities primarily on our energy efficiency efforts, which is the kind of brother of renewable energy, trying to cut our energy use. And so we certainly support the mission and the goals of ACEEE and, you know, are working towards that. In terms of, you know, was it fair? I think they missed some things, and I take full responsibility for not replying to their survey. So they did their best to find what they could on our website. Some things that they missed are related to city operations, where in fact, we do have an energy plan. We do have dedicated funding for energy efficiency. And we made strides with our police department and other departments to move towards hybrid and electric vehicles. So I estimate if we would have filled out their survey, we'd probably be in the lower 40s instead of where we were at 53 out of the 100 largest cities, which is, you know, better than what they had. But it's still, you know, I think far from where we need to go.
Still work to do. Yes. So, you know, regardless that they missed some things, do you feel scorecards like this are somewhat disconnected from the true realities that you face on the ground as you know, a sustainability director?
Well, I think it's a national scorecard. And so they are ranking cities that are in states from across the country, many of which have very different state level support and different policies regarding utilities and things like that. So I think we are doing, you know, really well given the context with this, with the state and our utilities, excuse me. But again, we can do more. So, you know, as in all things in governance, there's a local component, a state component, and a federal component. And, you know, really to tackle the threats and challenges of climate change, we've got to get together as a society and all levels of government and really start moving forward cooperatively together. I think we know climate change is caused by the excess use of fossil fuels, but it's been exacerbated by a lack of sustained political will across various levels of government. Fortunately, local governments, I think, are leading on this point, including in Milwaukee. And again, we've done a lot, and I hope we can touch on what we have done in the city. But we, as at the local level, have been partnering up with other cities around the state through what we call our Wisconsin Local Government Climate Coalition to push for changes at the state level that could help us reach our goals.
Hmm.
But that we also need to do everything within our power at the local level to move forward.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Eric Schamberger, who is the Environmental Sustainability Director for the City of Milwaukee, looking at the role, looking at what Milwaukee is doing, and talking about a scorecard. You can join in. How can your community do better at investing in green jobs? What do you want your city to do in its plan? 800-642-1234. You know, you talk about the connections between local, state, and federal federal government. And Wisconsin, as you know, is working on a plan to be powered by 100% carbon-free energy by 2050. Late last year, we talked with Maria Redmond, director of the state's Office of Sustainability and Clean Energy, who touched on a really key point about the relationship between cities and the state on clean energy goals.
There are things that are that need to be done that we want to show that we have support for, but we don't necessarily have control over. So, for example, local governments have great climate initiatives. And so the question is if you're a local government moving forward with your climate action plan or sustainability plan, what can the state do to help?
And I want to turn that to you. What can the state do to help, with Milwaukee's plan?
Well, sure. That's a great question. And first of all, I have great respect for Maria and the work she is doing at the state. It's exciting that the governor has outlined his climate goals, and a number of climate bills have been introduced at the legislature, most of which have not gotten a hearing. So I would encourage the legislature to give a fair hearing to climate issues in general, where, I think it's been largely ignored for the better part of the decade at that legislative level. At the administrative level, in terms of what the Evers administration could do, there is the statewide building code is set at the state level. So this dictates what is the minimum requirements are for energy efficiency and commercial buildings and residential buildings. Cities don't have control over that. The state sets that code. And so that's an opportunity for the state to really look hard at that code and say, is it enough to meet the challenges of climate change? And my answer is where it's going now, it's not. I mean, I think they need to raise their game when it comes to building codes.
And so
I
just want to pause there on building codes. What in particular is not in line, in step with these clean energy goals? What is lacking out of building codes in Wisconsin?
So there's an international code council that sets recommended goals. And it's fine for some states that have different climates to have a little bit different standards here. But we are essentially, we're just way behind the international code and where it needs to go. So there are things like requiring commissioning on large buildings, which means after you've installed it, making sure everything is installed correctly. We can do more with electric vehicle readiness in the codes. So I'm not a code expert per se, but I know we are, as the ratings go, we're behind other states.
Something else out of your control. How can cities like Milwaukee achieve these clean energy goals, particularly when you can't control your electricity supply? You don't have control over the utilities.
So we are advocating for more clean energy. One of the strategies we call greening the grid. And we do need more renewable energy options for cities. Some cities around the country have the option to purchase renewables from different providers. I'm not advocating for that. I have advocated, and we've worked with a coalition of local partners to talk to We Energies and say, look, we've got clean energy goals. We need you to provide more options to us to help them reach that. We did see some good progress in 2021. This year, we cut the ribbon on a 2.25 megawatt solar project that We Energies helped us build on a city landfill next to General Mitchell Airport. It's the largest solar project in the city of Milwaukee's history. And we have a proposal in front of them that we hope we can work together where we could purchase large amounts of renewable sources from them and work together with them to construct large-scale utility renewable projects. So I hope that's something that we can make some progress on in the next few months here, actually.
We're talking with Milwaukee's Environmental Sustainability Director, Eric Schamberger, works at the intersection of clean energy initiatives and the economy. What investments, what incentives, regulations are taking hold in your city to help our state shrink its carbon footprint? What steps have you taken to become more environmentally minded? Are these lifestyle changes sustainable? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Eric Schamberger on the Ideas Network. Thank you. We're in conversation with Milwaukee's Environmental Collaboration Office on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee and Madison were the only two cities in our state included on a national Clean City Energy Scorecard put together by the ACEEE, that's the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, measuring the progress of city policies and programs nationwide that reduce greenhouse gas emissions, move toward a cleaner energy grid. What innovations have you seen utilities, governments, companies make to reduce carbon emissions? Does your community have a climate action plan that it is committed to, that it is working on? Who created it? What results are emerging? 800-642-1234. Milwaukee's Environmental Sustainability Director Eric Schamberger with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Eric, Milwaukee aiming to have 25% of the city's electricity produced by renewable energy sources by 2025. That is soon. Will Milwaukee be able to meet that goal in 3 years?
I think we can if we can get participation from our utility, We Energies. As I mentioned before the break, we have a proposal to them to purchase large-scale amounts of power, and we need to get that approved by the Public Service Commission and our city council. But I'm hopeful we can get something done. That's part of our all of the above solar strategy, where we are also supporting what's called distributed energy. We have a Milwaukee Shines program that allows homeowners and businesses to install solar, and we help finance that as well. But to get to 25%, we need we need support from our utility for sure. We also have a 45% community-wide carbon reduction goal or greenhouse gas reduction goal by 2030, mm-hmm. and a net zero energy goal by 2050 to match the statewide goals. So we have a lot of work to do to hit those benchmarks, but I'm optimistic if we work together, we can do it.
Well, lift the veil, if you will, on what the day-to-day work is like inside your environmental collaboration office. You're working with people, since collaboration is in the name, but with whom and for what results? What is this like?
Well, that's a great question. I have worked, over the last decade to get sustainability and built into what city government does. So I would say about half the work is getting other city departments and working on initiatives and getting support for sustainability across operations. For example, we have an energy reduction team that works with the facility managers of the library and public works and the police department to identify opportunities to cut energy, to help them transition their fleets to renewable energy. So that's part of it. And then part of it is running programs and writing grants to fund work. So we have our ME2 program, helps homeowners do energy efficiency improvements like insulation and furnaces and boilers. And we've been able to set up a financing program to do that. We also have a PACE financing program that's been very successful. Over $30 million worth of energy efficiency projects and commercial buildings funded. So we run programs, we try to influence city operations to be more sustainable. And then we also try to be leaders in the community and work with any community organization or others around the state to help us meet our shared goals. I think there's so much interest in the community, that people that want to help. And so part of my job is to help channel all that energy in the right direction. Fortunately, we are City Council and County Board have passed a city-county task force on climate and economic equity. Mm-hmm. And we have some great partners, and we have a plan coming forward that I think will really help us move forward in these rankings.
I was going to ask just that, about this equity plan. You've held some public hearings last year to get community input. What is going on there?
So we have these twin goals of addressing climate change, but also racial inequities. And so as we do this transition to a clean energy economy, we want to create new opportunities for people of color to improve their economic standing and equality in the area. And we have identified 10 big ideas. I won't go through all of them here, but some of the highlights, I think, are a Green and Healthy Homes program, which has already gotten funding from the city through the American Rescue Plan Act. And what we're trying to do there is target coordinate energy efficiency efforts in low-income homes with lead abatement work, mm-hmm. that the health department is doing. So that's one we're excited about. And then one other one that I'll highlight quickly is within the ACEEE rankings, One of the practices that they are encouraging nationally is commercial energy benchmarking, which means the big commercial buildings, having them report on their energy use annually to try to add transparency to how they're using energy and hopefully create kind of a market incentive for them to make energy efficiency improvements.
For many households, solar panels, installing them, that's just out of reach, too costly. What can Milwaukee do to make energy efficiency more affordable at the household level?
Well, so we have two programs, one for energy efficiency, that's our ME2 program, and then for solar, it's Milwaukee Shines. And mm-hmm. so what we try to do is make it really easy for homeowners to, first of all, get financing for these things so they can get a loan. We have a partner at Summit Credit Union that can provide loans to do these things, so you don't have to come up with the funding out of pocket. These things can pay for themselves over time, but sometimes people don't have the upfront money to do it. So we have loans available. We have incentives through March through the ME2 programs, basically rebates. We help people use the statewide Focus on Energy program to get rebates. And then with Milwaukee Shines, we have what we call a group buy program where we work to hire a single contractor that can bring bulk pricing to this. So I think homeowners and doing the right thing there is part of it, but I also view my job as helping make the entire system work better so that it's not so hard for people to do the right thing.
We're talking with Eric Schamberger, who is Environmental Sustainability Director for the City of Milwaukee, looking at Milwaukee's plans now and in the future in the transition to clean energy. 800-642-1234 to join in. So, Eric, let's zoom out now to the federal level, which we really haven't talked about. The federal infrastructure law includes billions of dollars to help capture carbon released by power plants. It has other green energy related goals and money attached to it. And then there's ARPA funds and the grants that cities can go after. What are you focused on in the federal level?
Well, there's a lot to like in the infrastructure bill. So I'm grateful that that passed, as well as the American Rescue Plan Act. So with the infrastructure bill, there's a lot of funding for electric vehicle charging stations. So I see that as a real big opportunity for the cities and the state to upgrade their infrastructure to allow for charging in electric vehicles. This month, we're working very hard on a grant application to support what we're calling a Green Jobs Accelerator. So trying to really make this vision real for getting people of color in the green jobs of the future, many of which include electricians. I think that's a real opportunity. For people to have family supporting wages, as well as other water jobs to support lead abatement and things like, plumbers and the like, as well as more technical jobs. So workforce, electric vehicle charging. And then I do think there's additional things the federal government can do. They have the Build Back Better bill, which hasn't crossed the finish line yet, but that has a lot of other things to like that could really help cities in this country move forward in a meaningful way on climate change.
I want to ask you, does setting a clean energy goal with a deadline like 2050, that's a far off deadline. Can that be an impediment? Can you achieve anything meaningful today when you know 2050 is a generation away?
Yeah, I don't spend a ton of time thinking about 2050. I'm focused on the 2025 goal mm-hmm. and the 2030 goal, because you're right. You know, the urgency of climate change is we need to set short-term goals. And I think, you know, technology improvements will help the 2050 goal, but, there's opportunities on the table right now that we have to go get. And chief among those is investing more heavily in renewable energies in the state of Wisconsin.
So opportunities on the table, what should other cities take from Milwaukee's plan? What should they replicate?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to have dedicated sustainability staff. I mean, this report was in the largest cities. Many of our smaller cities do not have dedicated staff. And I do think that's important. That's a good first step for any community, is to assign someone to work on these goals. There's a lot of toolkits that are out there. Communities don't have to, start from square one on climate change. I mean, there's a lot of best practices, many of which are outlined in the scorecard that are a good starting point for many communities. So that's number one. Number two is thinking about sustainability as a core function of local governments and any unit of government, as well as corporations. I mean, I think we are at a point where you really need to have sustainability as something that is reported on, and again, someone's working on. So for particular programs, I'm happy to share with any other community who wants to give me a call, some opportunities, things they can do to support it locally.
So collaborating and transparency. Yep. Go ahead. Yes, we have a few seconds left.
Yeah, and I just want to support funding from the state as well. I mean, I think we talked about things that they can do, and a big piece of our plan is on transportation. My view is there's plenty of money being spent in our state. We just got to spend it in the right way and support things like transit, support the infrastructure in existing communities to help us meet our goals as well.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Eric Schamberger, Environmental Sustainability Director for the City of Milwaukee. Ahead this hour, we learn about the possibility of life on Venus as astronomers see a signal in its clouds. What questions do you have about Venus? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a journey to a Hmong New Year celebration.
Like many festivities, Hmong New Year celebrations were put on hold in the first year of the pandemic. Some gatherings returned this last year, including a New Year celebration at Sheboygan North High School. As we continue to settle into 2022, Gong Sua Xiong brings us the sounds and voices from that event.
I sat in the gym and watched as the opening dancers began their performance. People were quickly snapping their grand entrance photos before pouring in to join the main event.
Hmong New Year is a time to celebrate, gather family and friends together, make new friends, and find soulmates.
Sheila Ya is the co-chair for Hmong Mutual Assistance Association, the organization in charge of hosting this year's Hmong New Year in Sheboygan.
I think COVID played a role that gave a lot of individuals, families, friends, and the community a different perspective. It gave them a way to see a different way of life, that gathering means something to you. So this year, it brought out everyone back to spend time with each other.
The lobby is also full of people. There are people waiting in line for Hmong food. The menu consists of rice, chicken, papaya salad, and so much more. And there's an even longer line of people ordering bubble tea. There are vendors selling fruits and vegetables, clothing and jewelry, and other merchandise. Fashion is very important in the Hmong culture. Most people today are dressed in a jacket with embroidered textile, a white pleated skirt or black pants wrapped under a waistband. And of course, the entire outfit is adorned with beads and jewelry. You hear that jingling sound? That's the sound of coins. Silver coins are also a big part of traditional Hmong clothes. Historically, these coins represented wealth.
Everyone is dressed up in beautiful outfits.
Meng Xiong is a sponsor from the Wisconsin United Coalition of Mutual Assistance Association.
You know, I love the Hmong New Year. I grew up going to it every year. We get to showcase talent with dance, singing. Bei Jiu Long Gao Hmong.
Bei Jiu Long Gao Hmong means our young Hmong woman.
And the pageants.
The best performers win a trophy and up to $1,000 in prize money, which they often use to cover travel and clothing expenses. The hallway next to the stage and audience is bustling with dancers preparing for their performances.
When I did perform after COVID-19, it was just really exciting.
Pamela Va is a dancer from the dance team Ling Mom Hong, which in English translates to Hong Sisters.
I know a lot of dance teams they had a lot of ideas, even more ideas throughout the pandemic, and they have become a lot more creative. You're just ready to come out and show everyone what you got.
Take these opportunities to come join us. I would say challenge yourself to immerse yourself in another person's culture. We have a lot in common. You just grow so much as a person when you open your heart and your mind to other cultures. So come join us.
Gong Sua Xiong brought us that story on a Hmong New Year celebration in Sheboygan. She's a student at UW-Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to Venus and what some astronomers call a long overlooked planet in the search for extraterrestrial life. Venus is often called Earth's twin, roughly the same mass as our home planet. And that leads us to the question, could there be life on Venus? What can it tell us about climate change on the planet Earth? All things Venus, 800-642-1234. Sanjay Limaye is a distinguished scientist at UW-Madison Space Science and Engineering Center. Sanjay, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back with WPR.
Well, remind us, where is Venus located from the Sun, and what are its features? What are its characteristics?
Well, Venus is the second closest planet to the Sun, situated between Mercury and Venus. And it is roughly the same size. It has a similar mass. And we believe that both Venus and Earth and all the planets basically formed at the same time from the solar nebula. And given the similarities between the physical similarities between Venus and Earth, roughly the same size, same mass, both have atmospheres, the possibility of water being on the surface was considered in the 19th century. Svante Arrhenius, the person who first talked about greenhouse warming on Earth, had written about Venus possibly having oceans / forests on the surface in his book, published in the 1900s. And that led to the notion that Venus could have had creatures of trees, fauna, and things like that. And that led to many movies, Hollywood, not just Hollywood, but also in Russia, Germany, and other countries, you know, science fiction movies about life on Venus. Even Zsa Zsa Gabor, I believe, or Eva, one of the Gabor sisters, mm-hmm. I don't remember which one, was featured in. And then, you know, they had civilization, cultures, etc.
Well, but then, I was going to just jump in here on this journey through history in Venus. The late astronomer Carl Sagan once said that Venus is the planet in our solar system most like hell. What did he mean by that?
Well, Carl Sagan was one of the first scientists to actually look into the high temperatures of Venus. And history was that between these ideas of life on Venus on the surface, when we actually began to observe Venus with instruments, it became rather convincing that the surface of Venus was extremely hot, hot enough to melt lead, so they say, about 900 degrees, 950 degrees Fahrenheit. And that basically destroyed all ideas of life on Venus. And Carl was the one who first pointed out that a runaway greenhouse on Venus was the reason for the high surface temperature. Once we started looking at the clouds, and the clouds have been imaged for more than a century now, we see these light and dark patches in the blue UV images of the global cloud cover. And we can't explain those. We don't know what is absorbing the sunlight in the blue UV range of the spectrum. And so a few years ago, myself and a few colleagues just wondered if those could be due to some microorganisms in the clouds of Venus. So the idea got dissected just a few years ago.
Well, scientists have, as you look at the clouds, they've detected this chemical in Venus's atmosphere through telescope observations. And I'm just wondering, why are they so interested in this chemical phosphine?
Oh, phosphine is just one of several gases which are produced by life, but they can also be produced by chemistry, geochemistry. And the other two gases which have been ignored in the past are ammonia and methane. Ammonia was detected in the 1970s using a very simple instrument on a Russian probe that entered the Venus atmosphere. And methane was detected in a later probe by near Venus in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
And these three gases are not expected in a in an atmosphere with a composition like Venus's under equilibrium, which means everything is stable and, you know, nothing is changing sort of idea. Chemically, they are unstable in the atmosphere. So their presence is not expected. And that the first detection of ammonia led to some people commenting that it simply cannot exist there. And so people didn't pay much attention to ammonia. Methane, there hasn't been much discussion. You may recall that on Mars, methane was also detected from remote observations, and people raise the same objections. It simply can't exist because mm-hmm. it's not there. And then lo and behold, comes along Curiosity rover, and they find periodic, well, not periodic exactly, but sporadic detections of presence of methane in the Martian atmosphere. So, you know, science works in strange ways. Something, and then other people say, no, it can be true. And then other people try to go and verify it. So that's what's happening with Venus. But with Venus, there are just too many questions. And the trouble is that Venus is hiding all its secrets in plain sight of us, and we just can't probe through the clouds and understand everything we want to know about Venus.
Well, I want to jump in here because I want to know what camp you fall in then. If there is something curious or strange going on in the Venusian atmosphere, are you in the camp that, you know what, there might be life here? Or are you in that pushback camp that this is just, you know, mysterious or yet to be explained atmospheric or geologic processes going on Venus? Where do you stand?
Well, I hate to be put into a camp.
Us journalists like to put people in camps. We gotta separate.
No, I understand, but you know, camp works. Imaginations of the Gulag and the
Constitution. Not good. Okay, so there is a gray area as well. So you can be in the middle. Camps.
I'm sort of ambivalent. You know, I mean. I have been looking at Venus since my advisor, late Werner Sumi, on this campus. He was a member of the Mariner Venus imaging team. I happened to be his graduate student at that point. And when the first high-resolution images of Venus came back from that spacecraft, I was lucky enough to be able to work on them and measure the circulations. I was one of the first ones to measure the circulation with one Sumi and another colleague, Bob Krause, and we confirmed the rapid rotation of the Venus atmosphere and showed that the entire atmosphere was organized like a tropical cyclone in terms of its structure.
Tropical cyclone, wow.
Yeah, it's like a hurricane. You know, if you take a hurricane and move it over the pole of Venus and look down, that's exactly what it looks like, Venus on both poles, north and south. And that has been persistent since we discovered it in Mariner 10 data. And every image, every mission has basically confirmed that structure. What we still don't know, what is causing those contrasts. Sumi called them cumulus bituminous, sort of in a jocular fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Bituminous, it's like, you know, like coal. Mm. Now he not having too far off because carbon is one of the species that can indeed absorb ultraviolet light. But the trouble is that more than two dozen candidates have been proposed for these absorbers, and they can't be confirmed as the compounds causing the contrast. And so we proposed microorganisms because there are some bacteria on Earth which have similar spectral properties as the Venus clouds. So we just wondered whether it could be life, and why we can't confirm the identity is because we haven't been looking for a biological signature. So put me, you could say that, yes, I'm in the life camp. On the other hand, recently some colleagues have proposed that Venus could have never formed any oceans because it was always too hot and the water vapor remained in that form, in the atmosphere, and it could never condense. So now we had to go and address that question. Did liquid water actually exist on Venus? Because some colleagues of mine, Michael Way and Tony Tilgenio and others, have done some modeling work, and they proposed, or they actually concluded from their modeling studies, that if liquid water existed on the surface of Venus, it could have survived for more than 900 million years, maybe as long as 2 or 3 billion years ago.
Wow. Well, I just want to pause right here as we learn that Venus is just keeping us guessing. We have UW-Madison Distinguished Scientist Sanjay Limayee exploring the planets, Venus in particular, for more than three decades. Do you think there is life in Venus's atmosphere? Do you think NASA has been too laser-focused on getting to Mars and has overlooked studying Venus? What do you want to know about Earth's so-called twin? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're learning about Venus news, getting some planetary updates with a distinguished planetary scientist from UW-Madison on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to news out of Astronomy Magazine yesterday, a research team from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, preparing the first private mission to Venus to search for life. Target launch date is May of next year. How do you feel about the Venus Life Finder mission? What do you think of the role of universities and private companies and NASA in the search for what is out there? Planetary explorations, 800-642-1234. UW-Madison, Sanjay Limayee of the Space Science and Engineering Center with us for about six more minutes. Sanjay, what do you make of this mission from MIT and this Life Finder mission from and what they plan to do?
I think it is exciting, and it is great to see some private companies putting their money towards looking for life on Venus. NASA, being a publicly funded agency, typically has to take a more cautious approach and a measured approach, you know, go step by step, because they have to answer to Congress and to the public. But this is a nice set of three missions proposed by Sarah Seeger and her colleagues, and I hope they succeed.
Well, they told Astronomy that this is high-risk, high-reward science and stands to possibly answer one of the greatest scientific mysteries of all. What are the risks in a mission like this?
Well, the first mission is a mini probe. They had to launch it, get it to Venus, then it enters the atmosphere at a very high speed. So the probe will experience extremely high decelerations. It's like running into a brick wall, in a sense. So the instruments have to survive. It has only one instrument, as far as I know. And then the data has been collected as the probe falls through the clouds, and it will pass through the cloud layer in just a matter of minutes, maybe 3 to 5 minutes, and send the data back, and we have to receive it appropriately on Earth. And it's not clear exactly what their scheme is to collect the data, but I'm sure they know what they're doing. And
You'll be watching. Yes. Let's take a call now. Bruce is joining us from Holman with a question about Venus. Bruce, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I'm a member of the La Crosse Area Astronomical Society. And my personal question is, with the mixture of greenhouse gases and volcanic activity on Venus, especially the mixture of greenhouse gases, is does Venus present itself as a cautionary tale for what could be in the future of our own planet if we don't curtail our use of fossil fuels and production of methane and CO2 and greenhouse gases?
Bruce, thank you. Sanjay?
Excellent question. And yes, in a sense, we are going to warm up. The volcanoes have a dual role in controlling climate. They put out a lot of sulfur ash particulates. They can rise very high in the atmosphere and cause cooling. Recall the summer of no crops in the 1800s when a volcano in the Philippines blew up the climate was quite cooled. On the other hand, it does pump more greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide into it. About the amount of methane, I'm not sure. But the most recent eruption in Tonga was underwater. It was enormous. Even though it was underwater, the cloud went up 20 miles up into the air. So that's not good. However, in the far distant future, the sun will not continue shining at the current rate forever. It will eventually start losing its fuel, and it will start getting bigger and bigger. And as it expands, it will essentially cover up first Venus, then Earth, and then keep on expanding out. By that time, it'll be too late for anybody to survive. It'll be too hot. So it is known in the far distant future. The question is, by pumping more carbon dioxide, are we going to make it even sooner? We have a lot of water, so it's going to take a lot of time before we lose the oceans and become Venus-like. However, life doesn't cannot survive if the global average temperature is more than 42 degrees or something around that time, average temperature. So it's going to cause some grief for a lot of civilization.
Well, Sanjay, thank you so much for joining us and explaining the science.
Thank you.
Sanjay Limaye is a distinguished scientist at UW-Madison's Space Science and Engineering Center. Just ahead, we talk with a toxicologist and emergency medicine pharmacist about the management science and history of poisons. What do you want to know about poison? Join in, share your thoughts. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.